What are you doing here?
My bed was shaking. I can't get to sleep.
Who's Captain Howdy?
You know, I make the questions and he does the answers.
Oh, Captain Howdy, yeah, I see.
It's nice. You're gonna die up there.
Keep away! The sour's mine!
She's acting like she's fucking out of her mind, psychotic, like a split personality or...
Of course, there is one outside chance for a cure. Have you ever heard of exorcism?
You're telling me that I should take my daughter to a witch doctor.
If a person is, you know, possessed by a demon or something, how do they get an exorcism?
Well, the first thing, I'd have to get him into a time machine and get him back to the 16th century.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
Where's Reagan?
In here with us. Your mother's in here with his curse. Would you like to leave a message? I see that she gets it.
I'm Father Mary.
Stick your cock up her ass, you motherfucking worthless cocksucker.
Be silent!
I think it might be helpful if I gave you some background on the different personalities Reagan has manifested. So far, I'd say there seem to be three. She's convinced that
there's only one.
The power of Christ compels you! The power of Christ compels you! The power of Christ compels you!
The Exorcist, to me, is probably the scariest movie I've ever seen, and I'm turning 50. I turned 50 this year. The demonic possession theme, the child theme, saw the film way back when it first came out in the early 70s, and it has affected me ever since. So I have never seen a scarier movie.
Hello, and welcome back to Scream Addicts. I'm Jinx, your host, and that was Don May Jr. talking about William Friedkin's classic 1973 film adaptation of William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist. Mr. May is a producer who owns and operates Synapse Films, that kick-ass DVD and Blu-ray label that always has the most impressive table setup at any horror convention they attend. The Synapse label has released such films as Thriller, A Cruel Picture, Vampiros Lesbos, Demons and Demons 2, Popcorn, Tenebrae, and Phenomena. And those last five titles are available in some truly gorgeous steelbook editions that are well worth picking up. In addition to that, they are also going to be releasing Suspiria in a special edition for its 40th anniversary. And that's probably the most anticipated disc release I can think of coming up anytime soon. So I can't wait for it. So anyway, Mr. May, thanks so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome. Glad to be here.
So this podcast has been going on for about a year now, at least in this form. And on our last episode, we had a first, our first return guest in the form of Jerry Smith. And with this episode, we have another first. We have a returning film. Longtime listeners will recall that Tom McLaughlin chose to discuss The Exorcist for his episode. And I think it was pretty much exactly a year ago. Yeah. But The Exorcist, though, is a classic. I got to imagine it's going to be chosen many more times, in the future. Now, it is, the movie's an all-time classic. I think that's probably indisputable. It's brilliant. It's terrifying. It's pretty much perfect. But all that aside, when given the opportunity to choose any horror film to talk about at length, why is it that you zeroed in on that one? I mean, you discuss it a little bit in the opening, but what made your mind immediately leap to The Exorcist?
I'm 50. I turned 50 this year. The Exorcist came out in, 73, 74. I was seven, 8 years old at the time when it came out. And my sister had gone with her friends. We had a drive-in in the little old town of Lincoln, Illinois, where I grew up. Had a drive-in everybody went to. And you remember in the drive-ins, they have the little speakers in the cars. Our drive-in did not have the tune into the AM/FM radio frequency to get the sound. We had the little speakers that you put in the window. And she recorded it because she knew that she could terrify her little brother with the sounds from The Exorcist.
Oh my God.
So she went and she would play pranks on me. She was 10 years older than I was, she's about 8 years older than I am. So when I was very young, she would go, hey, I'm going to go over to my friend's house and I'll be across the street, you know, when mom and dad come home, you know, you'll be fine by yourself. I'm right across the street. And she'd go into her bedroom, turn on the tape recorder and leave it on and then leave. And I would hear all the, you know, in the bedroom, you know, and she knew it freaked me out. And I got really, really upset about it. But even at that age, when she was doing that to me in 73, 74, whenever she saw it, I know back then movies played for years sometimes because they just did. I was like, what is this? And she told me. So I wanted to go see it, which was probably, in hindsight, the biggest mistake I ever made as a child. Because we went, and it terrified me. And I mean, by terrified, I mean, I slept in my parents' bed for months after I saw it. I cried while I watched it because, I mean, look, my family grew up in Central Illinois. We were when I was younger, we were church on Sunday people. My mother dragged us to church. I went to Sunday school. So, you know, that whole religion, God, the devil, angels, you know, if you're bad, you're going to hell. If you're good, you'll go to heaven, and you better get your shit straight. Otherwise, you know, you'll be damned, your soul, you know, this whole thing. It was all hammered into my head as a child. And I see The Exorcist, and it's about a child. You know, Linda Blair was, what, 10, 12 when she made that movie. So I could relate because I was a kid too. And seeing what she went through on screen, I thought, oh my God, this could happen to me. So it absolutely terrified me. You know, at that time, and, you know, when I was growing up, being a religious family, that whole religion thing in the movie was part of the stuff that terrified me, and it's been sticking with me ever since. And I'll make a confession. I have not been able to watch The Exorcist by myself. I mean, the first time I ever watched it by myself without friends was about 5 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I've never been able to sit through it by myself because it bugs me so much. Even though, you know, now I'm an adult and, you know, the movie itself, you know, still bothers me subliminally, you know, the noises, the tone, the whole thing about The Exorcist just really bothers me. And it just burned into my brain at a young age. And it's the only movie that's ever really terrified me in my entire life. I mean, I've been scared, you know, The Night of the Living Dead, seeing it on TV, sitting in front of the TV when I was a little kid, you know, with my nose against the TV screen, you know, that stuff kind of scares you. But the religious aspect of The Exorcist when I was little and the fact that I was going to church sort of made me think that this could happen to me too. And that's why those kinds of things, when you're a child, they stick with you your whole life. There are certain traumatic things that we all go through in our lives that we can't shake. And The Exorcist for me is that movie that I can't shake it, because every time I watch it, it still bugs the shit out of me every single time.
Did you disown your sister straight away, or did it take a few years for you to realize that that's what you needed?
Oh, no. My sister turned into the girl that took me to stuff before my dad did. You know, my sister took me to Alien, you know, like all those things. And then when my sister got out of school and went on with her life and moved out of the house, my dad took over. So my dad would be the one who took me to The Shining and My Bloody Valentine and all that stuff as a kid. It's like I always wanted to see horror movies. And I guess that I have to credit that to The Exorcist as well, because after seeing that movie and seeing how it affected me physically and mentally, even when I was a kid, I knew that I was fucked up by this thing. And so it's been my quest my whole life to see horror movies and finally find the one that's going to affect me worse than The Exorcist. And I have still not found it.
I think it's got to be older siblings who introduce us to things like that, too. My brother was much the same with me where, you know, when I was a kid, I was absolutely terrified of horror movies just because, you know, what kid is going to run directly towards something called a scary movie? No child wants to be scared. And yet, you know, my brother would inevitably put on movies and he would be like, just watch a little bit of it. No, it's fine. Look, if you want to hide your eyes behind a pillow. And then inevitably when the really terrifying stuff would come up, he would pull the pillow away. So I would see, you know, Jason Voorhees hacking some poor teenager to death. But nevertheless, there's that sort of feel that like, you know, I don't want to watch this. I don't want to watch this. I don't want to watch this. I can't see this. I really kind of want to know what's next. I really want to see more. What the hell has happened?
You know? It's an addiction, you know, the horror films for me. I mean, as an example, like The Exorcist, like I said, to me, it fucked me up because of the religious aspects. And, you know, I was, you know, the God, the devil, the whole thing was hammered into my head as a child because we went to church and Sunday school. But when I saw something like Jaws, okay, which came out in, what, 75, a few years after The Exorcist, my parents knew what The Exorcist did to me, because I was having nightmares. I was crying. I was curled up in a fetal position in between my parents when, you know, in their bed for 2 months after I saw the thing, horrified to go to sleep. And then Jaws comes around, right? And it's like the greatest, the commercials were like, they're making this, it's like, I got to go see this. Oh my God. And they're like, no. You're not going to go see this because we know what The Exorcist did to you. You know, it's going to fuck you up. And, you know, you're not going to see Jaws. Of course, I threw a fit. I don't want to see Jaws. All my friends are going to see it, and I'm not going to see it. And they're like, and I remember my mom and dad kind of giving each other the look, like, do we let him go or do we just say no? And they let me go to Jaws, and I had the best time. It didn't scare me at all. And you know why? I was 8, 9 years old when Jaws came out. You know why it didn't scare me? Because I lived in the middle of Illinois. There were no fucking sharks in Illinois. But the devil was always there. You know, he was there. God was always there. And they were like, oh, my God, you know, Jaws, what'd you think? And I was like, it was great. I thought it was a lot of fun. They're like, wait, what? It didn't scare you? I'm like, hell no. There's no sharks going to eat me here in the middle of friggin' Illinois.
So you never had that, like, irrational fear that kids do that there's going to be a shark in, like, an in-ground pool or a bathtub or something?
Right. I never had that. I was buying the shark game. Remember the shark game where you had to drag the garbage out of the shark's mouth and, you know, pull the plastic garbage out of the mouth and it was attached to a rubber band? And, you know, I mean, I had all the shark stuff. I was like, this is the greatest. But, you know, that stuff never scared me. It was the religious aspects that just burned into my brain. And now, you know, I'm not a real religious person, you know, in my older years. But there's always, in the back of my head, The Exorcist just, you know, it warped me. And it's like, you know, I just, every time I watch it with friends, I'm still like, okay, I can't, you know, deal with this. I mean, the whole, and it's not just the Reagan stuff, you know, with her being possessed. It's everything else too, you know, Father Marin, you know, battling, you know, his like demon again. You know, you get that sort of, okay, he's seen this before, so he's experienced. And then you got you got Father Karras, whose mom, you know, is dying and he's losing his faith. And all this other stuff. So there's all these aspects of The Exorcist itself that just really fuck with your head. It's a brilliant, brilliant piece of filmmaking. It's, you know, I think it's probably, outside of To Live and Die in L.A., William Friedkin's greatest achievement.
Oh, absolutely.
I really think that The Exorcist is, you know, it's my top horror film of all time.
Now, at around that same age when you were growing up and you were starting to get into horror movies, can I ask, were there any other types of films that dealt with that sort of, you know, the religious aspects of, you know, exorcism or even something like The Omen or, you know, in the 80s we had the Satanic Panic and all the movies that were sort of inspired by
that? Right.
Did those affect you in anything?
You know, The Omen, I don't really remember much about The Omen, but I have an Omen 2 story. Because they filmed Omen 2 near where I lived. And they filmed it in like an academy up north, you know, in Illinois, in Wisconsin. And they were doing casting calls. And I was at that age where I was like, wait a minute, I could be in The Omen. And I was like, I want to be in The Omen, Mom. I want to be, you know, let's go. I want to try out. And they refused to take me to the audition. They're like, no. We're not driving to Chicago so you can try out to be in a stupid movie. It's too far away, you know. And I was at that age where I could have been a kid at the police, at the military academy in Omen 2, and I didn't get it. But then when I finally saw the movie, I actually thought it was better than the first one, you know.
I
love the elevator thing.
Now, were they casting for Damien as well?
Huh?
Were they casting for Damien as well, or just
no? Extras? It was just they needed background kids for the. And, you know, back in that day, there was no internet. So I don't even remember how. It must have been in the newspaper or a newscast or something on the TV where they were talking about the movie being shot near, you know, Illinois, Wisconsin. And I was like, ooh, I want to do that. You know, let's go. And, didn't happen. Didn't happen for me. But yeah, I mean, all that stuff. I mean, there's a lot of those satanic, you know, theme movies. But The Exorcist, to me, is still the king. You know, it's like, and the thing that kills me is, you know, I hate to talk about it because there's a lot of things I don't like about it. But that version that you've never seen.
I was going to ask if you're more of a theatrical kind of guy or more of a version you've never seen before.
Yeah. Look, there's some aspects of the we'll get into what I like and what I don't like about it. But it came out in what, 2000,
yep.
I think, was when. And I went to the theater with friends. And I was like, okay, I've never seen it on the big screen before, since this new version. It's been since, like, you know, I saw it in a crappy drive-in, you know, 100 years ago. I want to see it in a theater with an audience. And it was this remastered version. And I couldn't believe the laughter from the kid, you know, the kids today. And it really... More so than the problems I had with the movie re-edited. But I was like, this is like the scariest movie to me. And these kids today, the teenagers are in watching it and they're laughing at everything. And I'm just like, wow, you know, times, they really do change.
How much of that, though, is the fact that the movie had been sort of relentlessly parodied throughout the years. And so what they're
saying, relating to laughs that they had. Yeah. I was taken aback at first because I was like, is that nervous laughter? I can understand if that's nervous laughter. Nope. These kids are laughing at the screen because they think what they're seeing is funny. And I just went, oh my God, you know, I grew up in a totally different world. You know, when she's shoving that crucifix up there and she's like, you know, Jesus, fuck you or whatever. And the kids are like, ha 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 ha, that's hilarious. I'm like, that's not hilarious. That's fucking horrifying. What, you know, and it kind of ruined it for me, you know, seeing it in the theater with other people like that, you know, new generation of kids that weren't even born when it came out originally. And I was just like, okay, I see I grew up in a different time.
I didn't have that experience. I had already seen the movie when I was a teenager, and it absolutely sort of fried my nerves. But I was working at a movie theater when it came out. I hadn't been there for very long, but I was a relatively new projectionist. And as soon as I heard that we were going to get it, I was like, I need to be the guy who puts this together and previews it after hours. And so the manager I was working with, he was like, you know, I've never seen it. And I was like, you've never, oh my God, you're in for a treat. So we put it in the biggest auditorium. It's midnight. The theater's already let out. Everybody's out of the building. We've locked the place down. Pitch black in the auditorium. We don't even turn on the aisle lights. And we start up the movie to preview it. And I sit there and watching it on the big screen for the first time. And I, you know, even though I have issues with that version of it, it was still amazing to see it on the big screen. And it worked like gangbusters the way it always does with every showing, whether it's on the small screen or the big screen. That is a movie whose power never dims for me. It's all, it always has the exact same impact every time as the first time. And, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm like white knuckling the theater chair, you know, and as soon as the, you know, and not a peep in the theater. It was only myself and the manager, and he didn't say a word. You could have heard a pin drop throughout the entire thing. And as soon as the credits hit, I look over like, huh? Wasn't that something? And he just kind of shrugged. He was just like, eh. You know, he was like, it was a good movie. He was like, it was a very good movie. It just wasn't scary at all. And me, I'm like, you know, there are beads of sweat on my forehead. You know, I'm shivering.
Yeah,
I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you that you wouldn't find that terrifying?
There's so much horrifying stuff in the movie, and I just, I don't know. Like, I mean, again, I'm 50, times change, kids change, you know, and just, I'm like, here's this movie that fucked me up for my entire life, and these people are laughing at the screen. You know, they're laughing at the spider walk. They're laughing at her masturbating with a crucifix. They're laughing at all the, you know, the pea soup and stuff, and I was like, this isn't funny. I mean, this fucked people up back in 74. You know, you read reports of people fainting and, you know, falling down in the aisles trying to run out. And, you know, I don't know how much of that stuff was actually real or, you know, publicity, you know, bullshit.
I never believed that somebody could actually pass out in a movie theater from a horror movie.
I saw someone pass out in a movie theater.
Oh, which movie was it?
Audition.
That makes sense. Was it the piano?
I was at Fantasia Film Festival, and Audition was having its premiere, and I watched someone. I mean, if you're familiar with the film, you know what it's about. And when she takes the wire, and she's like, and she's, you know, sawing that person's leg or whatever it was, or arm. I saw some guy bolt up the aisle, fall down in the aisle, and crack his head on the exit door.
You're kidding.
And then I was like, oh my God, that guy's never coming back. And then after the screening was over, I heard he passed out and bled on the floor of the men's room. And I was like, okay, I just watched someone, for the first time ever, I watched someone pass out in a movie theater. I thought I'd never see that.
Then maybe it's something with ankles then, because I got to tell you, I never thought I would see that happen. I worked in a movie theater for a decade and a half, and I've been there for the better part of a decade when Saw 3, of all movies, came out. There is that scene at the very beginning of the movie where the character is chained in the bathroom, you know, and it's sort of wrapped around his ankle, and he grabs, like, the broken toilet lid, and he smashes his ankle in. And I broke my ankle when I was a kid. So as I'm hearing that sound design and as he's bashing his ankle in, like, I started to get, like, mildly nauseous. And this is a franchise that has shown me many terrible things, many bloody, gory, awful things.
You've seen two other movies already. Yeah, you know what to expect, but it still gets to you.
I don't think there was actually any blood even. It's just the sound of his ankle, and then he grabs his foot and snaps it all the way. Now, that was on a Wednesday or Thursday when I previewed the movie. I kid you not, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, having never seen anybody pass out in a movie before, not from fright or disgust at a horror movie anyway, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, three nights in a row, three different guys collapsed. First guy was essentially the story you just told. He made it halfway up the aisle, apparently, collapsed. Yeah. He didn't hit the exit door, but he hit the carpeted wall right behind it. And until that theater was renovated about 7 or 8 years later, there was a head-sized dent in the wall where he had collapsed. Boom, hit his head in the wall. The next night, the second guy made it all the way out into the hallway before he collapsed. And then the third night, the guy made it out into the lobby and collapsed. And we eventually had to call an ambulance for him because he just kept collapsing. Like, he would stand up.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing, but I'm laughing only because I thought Saw 3 was so nasty compared to the other two. I actually, in my office, at the Synapse Films office, I have the poster of Saw 3 hanging above my desk. It's the one with the close-up of the teeth knocked out.
Yeah.
And the teeth are the three in Saw. And that's That's the one that I have hanging in my office because I always thought Saw 3 was so nasty. I'm like, man, this is...
It is also my favorite, I think, out of all of them. But I love the first one, but I love the first three. But yeah, and yeah, but weirdly enough, all three guys, all three times that they collapse, you know, these three different people... It was in the first 10 minutes of the movie. It was during the damn ankle scene. Every time a manager was called over, it was always at the very beginning in that sequence. And so I wonder if there's something, you know, especially, you know, I wonder if any of them were like me. I always wanted to ask, and I never crossed that line, but I was just like, did you ever have, like, a sports injury? Did you ever break your leg? Did you ever break your break your ankle? Was it something like that? But, yeah, nevertheless, I so.
Yeah, but, I mean, that goes back to me being brought up religious. You know, and why, you know, because of something that happened to me as a child or was happening, you know, being dragged to church, the subject matter of The Exorcist. I mean, look, the movie's got its, you know, the pea soup and the this and the that, and the Dick Smith makeup is phenomenal. But it's just because of the religious aspect that I think it just horrified me so much. And, you know, like these guys in Saw 3, if they broke their ankle or had a, you know, accident or something when they were younger, and they see that, it's like now that they're older, it still bothers them, you know? Same thing with me on The Exorcist. It's just that, you know, the way I was brought up, the way it was introduced to me, it's just fucked my head up forever. So, well, I mean, I tried, like I said, I tried watching it by myself a few years ago, first time ever, and I watched it on Halloween of all days, and because it's a Halloween movie, if you remember at the beginning of the movie, there's kids trick-or-treating as Reagan's mom is, you know, walking home, and I was like, I'm gonna watch The Exorcist because it starts on Halloween. And I was just like, okay, I'm watching this by myself, this is really fucked up, and it still bothered me, you know. But I'm old enough now where I can watch it now by myself, I think, and still be horrified, but I don't have to have that person in the same room with me. Like, what was that noise in the other room? You know, did I just hear somebody walking upstairs? You know, that kind of stuff.
That's funny, but, too. I mean, you got to imagine, I think the movie is widely considered to be one of the scariest movies ever made. And I got to imagine that a large part of the audience is, you know, perhaps agnostic or, you know, they're atheists. And yet, you know, one imagines that it still terrifies them. You know, there are, to think about it, there are plenty of movies, too, that, you know, dealing with ghosts or, you know, monsters, aliens, who knows, where, you know, it's something that as an audience member, I can sit down and not necessarily believe it before the movie starts. And yet, if the movie does its job, you absolutely, at least for the length of the movie, can believe, you know, that something like that might exist. So far as the movie, you know, having an impact on you. But there is something about The Exorcist where, you know, if you know, my background is such that it's religious too, and it does work, I think, even more so on that extra level, I think, for people like that.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's so much deliberate religion in the movie too. So William Friedkin knew who he was fucking with. You know, he was like, I'm going to fuck with these people. I mean, right at the beginning of the movie, you know, Reagan's mom, Ellen Burstyn, is, you know, on the set. And what do you hear the director yelling? I need a nun. I need a priest and some students now. You know, there was no reason for him to say that because they were at a protest, right? They were filming a protest about burning down a building. But yet William Friedkin inserted, hey, I need a priest. I need a nun, you know. And if you look at the doors in the house, the tops of the doors are crosses in the house, you know. So there's all this weird religious undertone through the whole thing. You know, Reagan, you know, finds the Ouija board, and her mom is not really religious at all. And maybe you think, is it the mom that's not religious that's causing this to happen to her daughter as punishment? Or is it because Reagan is playing with, oh my God, she's playing with a Ouija board. Ed and Lorraine Warren tell us never to use that Ouija board. You know, you're not supposed to play with those things by yourself or with anybody else. And Reagan is like, yeah, I play with it by myself all the time. I talk to Captain Haddock, like, oh shit, you know. So there's all this weird sort of religion, you know, kind of, you know, these connotations. I mean, it opens with, you know, Father, you know, Marin, you know, investigating, and you sort of like wonder, you know, has he, you know, he's obviously, he knows something that's going to be revealed later, and we find out that, yes, he's fought this demon before, you know, so all this crazy religious stuff in the film subliminally, and, you know, with the defiling of the church statue and stuff like that, which really, if you think about it, it doesn't really have anything to do with the film.
No.
So there's like this sort of religious desecration scene in the movie that really doesn't fit the narrative in any way. You could have removed that and it wouldn't have made any difference.
And the initial reaction is to wonder whether or not that, you know, possessed Reagan snuck out in the middle of the night and did it, you know?
Right. Yeah. But I mean, it's like, maybe she did. Yeah. But it's just like that could have been removed from the film and the film would have been just as effective, you know? So there's, it's all these weirdly, you know, religious things in the movie, and the tone, you know, it opens up with, you know that the mother loves the daughter. They have that whole scene where they're like, hey, what'd you do today? And, you know, I'm trying to remember, didn't Reagan steal a cookie from the kitchen? And then she runs and the mom is like, hey, get back here. And, you know, they wrestle playfully on the floor.
And there's even the little touches, like the great eyelash scene, you know.
Huh?
Oh, even like, you know, and I think Tom McLaughlin pointed this out before too, you know, I don't know that I'd ever paid too close of attention to it before, but like, you're right. Little moments like that, like her chasing her in, and then the scene where she's tucking her in and she removes the eyelash from her eye. It's just those little tiny brush strokes that make
them
human.
You're like, okay, they're human, but yet what happens next? In like almost the next scene, you see the mother insulting and screaming at an operator. She's trying to call Rome because her ex-husband forgot her daughter's birthday. And you see this fire, you know, from, I dare I say, fire and fury now, you know, after what's been going on. But you see that, hey, you know, mom can be a real bitch when she wants to be. And you see that, you know, Reagan is like cowering in the corner, like, what did I do wrong? You know, so there's a crack in the family unit, you know, and everybody has those moments, you know, where their family's not, you know, picture perfect with sitting on the porch drinking lemonade and playing with the dog outside. We all have our moments with our family. So it's just interesting. It's like, hey, look, they're not the, you know, the mommy and, you know, daughter family unit that's the picture perfect movie family unit. And then you see the crack, and then everything starts to escalate from there.
But it makes them so much more relatable, I think, too. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the main reasons the film is so incredibly manipulative, I think, is how much we come to love, you know, the characters in it, like Reagan and Chris and Marin. And, you know, even, you were talking about that, you know, the film shoot sequence. You know, I'm thinking of like the time when we first see Karis right off the bat. You know, I love that.
Right.
That one of
He's
the first
in the
moments.
Crowd. He's
yeah.
Like, yeah.
And, you know, he's just hanging out on the sidelines of this big film shoot that Chris is involved with. And there's that great lighthearted moment between she and, you know, Burke Devlin, the director. And it cuts to the crowd laughing. And that's the first time we see Karis. He's laughing his ass off. And he seems to be, like, utterly delighted at being there, you know, seeing that actress and, you know, seeing a film being made. And, you know, one could imagine most movies introducing, like, this priest character in, you know, essentially a horror movie as being more stoic or even grim. But when we first see him, he seems like a normal guy, and we kind of we like him straight away for it. And, you know, I think that's true of every character. There are these little touches that make them so very real in a way, a way that most movies horror otherwise don't quite capture.
Yeah, and then William Friedkin destroys them all in front of us for 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's like, hey, I'm not going to let these guys get off so easy. You know, let them have their moments. But, you know, I'm going to kill this guy's mom. I'm going to, you know, it's just like, oh, my God. And, you know, I mean, even, you know, Father Marin, when he's, you know, they have that whole thing at the beginning where he's at the dig and, you know, and he finds the little thing and the clock stops and everything, you know that something's up. And then he sort of, I mean, honestly, I don't even think that the two priests meet until the movie's about half an hour from being over with.
Yeah.
You know, and when they, and the, you know, and you're like, okay, you know, Father Marin, he's a badass. Looks like, you know, he's going to come back. And he walks into the house and he's so assertive. And it's one of my favorite, I mean, and no one talks about this scene. And it's my favorite scene in the entire film when he comes to the house and he's getting his things together. And I think, doesn't Kitty Wynn offer him some tea or something? And he's like, he says a little thing. And they get prepared to go up to the bedroom where Reagan is. And he puts on the shawl, or forgive me, I'm not Catholic, so I don't know what that thing's called, but he puts it on and he goes up there. And there's this moment, and I think the moment is in only the director's cut or the version you've never seen, when he asks Reagan's mom what her middle name is. And she tells him, and he goes, oh, that's a very nice name. So you see this guy, he's sort of like, okay, down to business. You know, Father Karras, he's confused, he's conflicted. His mom's dead. He's haunted by his faith. Here comes this priest that is, you know, hey, I'm going to get the job done. Let me at it. You know, I'm going to put my shit on. I'm going to go up in there, and I'm going to get this job done, and it's going to be over. And he walks in to the bedroom, all stoic, you know, it's like, hey, and then Father Marin comes in, and then Friedkin frames him in such a way when the door shuts, he looks horrified. Like, okay, now what? And my favorite scene is this, there's this little moment of silence when they go into the bedroom and, you know, Father Marin is like getting his stuff repaired, and you know, he gets the little holy water out and everything else, and it's silent. And then all of a sudden, Reagan goes, stick your cock in her ass, you know, motherfucker, or whatever. And it's like, okay, that, I, if you watch it again, it's like the most amazing moment in the film. It's like this moment of, okay, here's this badass, here's this guy that's having some problems with his life. They're going to go figure out what's wrong with Reagan, and Reagan's just going to, you know, throw some shade at him as soon as they walk in the door. And I fucking love it, you know. It's like, stick your cock in her ass, you stupid motherfucker, or whatever she says. And it just comes after this uncomfortable moment of silence. And it's genius. And, you know, and I never hear anybody talk about that particular sequence, you know, and I'm like, this is amazing, because William Friedkin is disarming both of these guys right now. And you know, the audience is completely thrown for a loop, because at that moment, you don't know what's going to happen. You know, you're introduced to two preachers that have two different, you know, faiths, and, you know, one doesn't really have any faith. The other guy is like, okay, I'm the badass exorcist. I'm going to get the job done. And then in a snap of a finger, William Friedkin, like, just, you know, throws shit into a blender for you, you know? And I love that.
And those moments too. Like,
you know, and of course, we all know what happens after that moment. You know, you see that both of these guys start to break, you know? The badass exorcist ain't so badass. You know, they leave and they're exhausted, you know, after the first quote unquote battle. And the one scene that he did put in the version you've never seen that I think is the most important one is the scene with them talking on the stairs. And I don't quite understand why that was removed from the movie in the first place. But that scene where where Karras goes, why her? Why this little girl? And Marin is like, maybe he, you know, he just wants to, I can't remember the exact line, but he says maybe he's just trying to drive people nuts. Maybe it's meant to deceive us or whatever, you know, to kind of throw us all for a loop.
Is it something, is there, I don't know if it's in the version you've never seen before in the theatrical cut, but I remember one of the moments like that where they talk about the potential you know, the motive, as it were, of Pazuzu or whatever, where he says something like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah, they never call him Pazuzu in the movie, by the way. But, you know, I think it's kind of funny that everyone's like, yeah, it's supposed to be Pazuzu, but they never mention it as Pazuzu in the film, really, by name.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they never do. You know, and it's like they talk about him being the devil himself, but the Pazuzu thing, I guess, stuck just probably because it was in the book or the script or something. But yeah, you know, that little moment where they're on the stairs after they first go in and they're just like, okay, let's leave and regather our thoughts and we'll go back in. You know, that little moment's great. You know, there's some but, you know, some of those choices he made in the version you've never seen just kind of infuriate me. If I was at a screening, an advanced screening, I think, what was the William Friedkin movie with Benicio del Toro?
The
where
Hunted?
He played like a mercenary. Was it The Hunted or something?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. I was at an advanced screening of that, and William Friedkin sat in the seat right in front of me.
Oh, wow.
And I wanted so badly to talk to him. You know, and you know, and just see, you know, what was up, but I left him alone. But, you know, I'd like to know why he changed some of the things he changed in the version you've never seen, because some of the choice, I mean, he's now on record saying that he prefers this version, I guess, now over the original, but those additional, like, you know, Eileen Deet's faces on the stove, I mean,
yeah.
Just that stuff drives me crazy. That it ruined it for me. I mean, and the opening shot of, instead of opening on the desert or whatever, we open on a quick shot of the apartment for no apparent reason. And it's like, why did you put this in here? What, you know, what are you doing? You know, you're going from an apartment to, what is it, Iraq or something?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's like, dude, seriously, you know, why did you put that 2-second shot of, you know, the apartment building before the Iraq stuff? And, you know, some of that stuff just, you know, I like the little tape recording thing. You know, where he's listening to the tapes of her talking and stuff. But some of that version you've never seen stuff, I could take it or leave it. Even the spider walk, I thought, was kind of
lame.
You know, it was. And, you know, it's different, too. If you watch the documentary that is, I think, the UK documentary, it's like totally different.
Right? Or something.
Yeah,
like that.
She's got the tongue and everything. And it's like, well, what did they do here? They must have redone something because it doesn't look right.
Doesn't,
you know,
she
doesn't
spit
look like
blood
the
out now or something?
Yeah,
like that?
Yeah. And I'm like, is that even her or is that an actress? You know, is that some other actress that looks like her doing that? Because, you know, I'm just like, well, wait, that's not the tongue thing. So, you know, it's, I don't know. I mean, you know, and the other thing, too, that bothers me is this misnomer that the original version is still the original version when it's not. And I have the very first DVD of The Exorcist that came out way back when DVDs first came out. And it was in like a green cardboard snapper case. And it had The Exorcist 5.1 mix on one side and the mono mix on the other, which was like, okay, this is the original mix. And then later on, they came out with like box sets or whatever, like the version you've never seen that says, okay, we've got this version, but the original theatrical version is included too. And it's not. There's that stupid morph at the end that drives me crazy. I pull my hair out every time I see it.
Morph at the end?
There's a morph at the end of The Exorcist. They didn't have morph in 1974. we couldn't Terminator 2 stuff in 1974, and William Friedkin changed the jump cut when Karras says come into me and jumps out the window. They morphed it, and it's still listed as original theatrical version. It's like, bullshit. That's the morph is not in the original theatrical version. There was a jump cut there. And they've somehow said, now I guess that version is their de facto original theatrical version when it's completely not. And it drives me crazy because in 1974, they didn't have morphing computers to do that.
I got to admit, I wasn't going to mention this, but I had never noticed that before until this last rewatch in advance of this conversation. And it looks like the white sort of melts away on his face. And I was just like, whoa, wait a second, is that? And I didn't think about it because I was, you know, I was making notes and whatnot, but I was just like, yeah, I remembered that differently. And as soon as you mentioned that, I was like, wait a second. Okay. Yeah. So it was a jump cut before.
Yeah.
Damn it. You know?
Yeah. There was in the original version, it was a jump cut because that's what they did in 1974 when you wanted to turn somebody into somebody else. you know, you have like a weird optical, like, you know, the Wolfman, or you do a quick jump cut where, you know, Karis gets possessed really quickly and then jumps out the window. And it's like, wow, I can't believe that they're passing that off as the original theatrical version, you know, because it's not. And it's always bugged me. And one of the things I've, you know, wanted to do in my career, you know, one of the movies on my bucket list is The Exorcist. And I would love to restore it back to the way it was, you know, with the jump cut and the original red, you know, Warner Brothers logo at the beginning, you know, because it always had that weird red logo that like zoomed in, you know, with the W, and they've removed that too.
Why do they feel the need to tamper with something going to note is the original cut?
Well,
anyway,
Liam Friedkin's like Michael Mann, you know, they tend to tinker. I mean, look what Friedkin did to French Connection. Oof, you know. And then Owen Roizman was like, you know, fuck him for what he did to the movie. That's not the one I shot.
Didn't they release two Blu-rays after that controversy? I remember Roizman coming out and saying the damn movie is not meant to be purple or something like that.
Right, right. Yeah, it doesn't look like it was shot through, you know, a screen door and desaturated with, you know. But, yeah, I mean, you know, but look, he's the director. He can tinker if he wants to. But as a consumer, I can choose not to buy that version if I don't want it, you know. You know, it's like, you know. But, yeah, I mean, The Exorcist is still, you know, still tinkered with. That original theatrical version is not really the original theatrical version.
Well, not even the movie, too. Like, there's also, you know, the fact that it ultimately became a franchise. And I was going to ask, I mean, since mm-hmm. you're such a big fan of the original movie, what are your mm-hmm. thoughts on the various follow-ups that we've had from the, you know, the feature film sequels to the TV show?
I want what John Borman was smoking. That's what I'll say about the second one. Because that, to me, I mean, people hate Exorcist 2. I mean, they're just like, oh, my God.
It has some really cool stuff in it. It is terrible, but, I mean, there is some really interesting things.
I love it. I was like, and I love it for the reason that the studio, Warner Brothers, came off of what I think even today in a – I mean, they've come out with a bunch of blockbusters like, you know, Wonder Woman and stuff. But in adjusted dollars, I think The Exorcist is still – like their most successful movie.
What?
And in adjusted dollars, I think The Exorcist has still made more money over the years than anything else that they've ever produced. And the thing about it is you go off of this huge box office hit. I mean, The Exorcist was a huge thing. I went to the drive-in to see it with my sister. I mean, it was a thing. Everybody wanted to see it. It was the scariest fucking thing you'd ever seen. And it played, and people were affected by it, like myself. And then you come out with The Exorcist 2. And the studio had to be going, what the fuck are we doing? You know, I mean, you can't look at Exorcist 2 and go, well, this was a logical progression. You know, and it's like, oh, my God, you got, you know, poor Cloris Leachman and, you know, or not Cloris Leachman. What am I talking about?
No, I know what you're talking about. It just made me laugh because you said Cloris Leachman.
Yeah. I mean, Cloris Leachman. What am I thinking? I haven't had enough to drink yet today. But, you know, I mean,
I want to see the Exorcist sequel with Cloris Leachman.
You know, but I mean, you got people wearing, you know, these weird hypno things, and you got, you know, weird like opticals of locusts, and, you know, poor, you know, James Earl Jones in like a native outfit. You know, it's like, what in the fuck are they thinking? And and poor Kitty Wynn, you know, poor Kitty Wynn didn't come out of Exorcist 2 unscathed like she did in the first one. You know, the poor girl. But
well, the places they take her character to is just bizarre.
The creepiest thing about The Exorcist 2, and I, you know, it just came out on Blu-ray, and I'm, you know, people are going to be like, wow, that's really perverted that you're talking about this. But if you watch The Exorcist 2 on Blu-ray, it's really creepy because you know that Linda Blair is still like teenager. I mean, she's like, what, 14, 15 in The Exorcist 2?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's that scene on the roof where she's in her nightgown and she's like standing on the edge of the building, and you can, the Blu-ray is so clear, you can kind of see through her outfit, and it's like really creepy.
I have not seen the Blu-ray yet.
Like, okay, wait.
Yeah, I've watched The Exorcist 2
in my basement.
Once.
I have like a 12-foot screen, you know, with a projector, and I was watching The Exorcist 2, and I was like, ooh, that's really weird.
So if we could see that on a Blu-ray, how the hell did they not pay attention to that on set?
I know. It's like, wait, you can kind of see a little too much there in the resolution of the Blu-ray. That's really weird, you know.
Boring.
I'm sure you could see it on the film, too. But just the simple fact that they probably went from like an earlier element than a print, which isn't, you know, three or four generations down from a negative, which would kind of add more grain and kind of, you know, soften that kind of stuff. You know, you're seeing something that's probably transferred from the original negative right out of the camera, and it's like, whoa, that's weird, you know. but Exorcist 2, I have a blast when I watch it.
I need to give it
so
another shot.
Nuts.
I need to give it another shot. There was a past guest on, Matt Serafini, who discussed actually The Exorcist 3. And I don't think he outright defended the movie, but he pointed out that it had more merits than people often give it credit for. So I've been wanting to sort of marathon the entire franchise, to start at the very beginning and sort of sort of watch them
and
all.
Let's
I
not
did
forget.
That.
Let's not forget. And I'm not the only one that thinks this. The trailer for The Exorcist 2 is one of the greatest movie trailers ever made.
I've not seen it.
Oh, my God. You have to see the trailer. The trailer is genius. It's like a big music video. And I think it's on the Blu-ray. So, you know, you got to give that a whirl. That trailer for The Exorcist 2 is like one of the greatest trailers I've ever seen, you know, cut for any film ever.
All right, immediately going home and popping that in.
Because it's so fucking crazy. It's like, oh my God, they were really on drugs back then. You watch The Exorcist 2 and you just, to me, it just doesn't make sense that they would go from The Exorcist to that. You know, you think of like other horror sequels, you know, since, and you're like, okay, well, you know, Friday the 13th, part one, part two, that makes sense. You know, they progress the story in a way that sort of makes sense. Exorcist 2 is just fucking bonkers.
It really is.
But then you're dealing with John Borman. So, I mean, it's the guy who made Zardoz. So what do you expect?
I will give the franchise credit for that. You can bounce from movie to movie to movie. To prequel to TV show. And
yeah,
it doesn't appear as though any of those films is following a formula at all. You know,
right.
they're all quite different from one another. And I guess even when they don't work, The Exorcist 2, for example, I mean, even though I will give it another whirl, I promise. I will give that movie another shot again someday.
Believe me, I love it for all the wrong reasons. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. You know, I think the movie is an incredible misfire, but I have such a fun time watching it. And in my head, I'm thinking, how many executives at Warner Brothers at the time looked at this and kept their mouth shut?
How many of them watched it and just thought, yes.
They're like, okay, I'm not saying anything because I don't want to, you know, I don't want to lose my job, but this movie's a pile of shit. You know, I can imagine the the executive's going, holy mackerel, what did we make? You know, I mean, it's a total 360 from the first film in just about every way. And, you know, it's like one of these giant misfires. You know, you're coming off of the most successful horror film ever made at the time, and arguably one of the most successful films ever made at the time, and you get Exorcist II. It's like, holy shit.
Although, to be fair, I mean, The Exorcist III, that did sort of, that brought the train back on the track.
Exorcist III is genius. You know, now I haven't seen The Exorcist III in a long time.
It's brilliant.
But, you know, it's I saw the film when it first came out in the theaters, and I was just like, wow, this is really amazing, because it's sort of like a side story, you know. And I went and I read the book, and, you know, the book is crazy, too, you know, but it's so good.
The one thing that I miss from the book that is not in the film is Kinderman's, and I don't really want to spoil it for listeners who maybe haven't given the book a read yet, but the ultimate conclusion that Kinderman comes to about the nature of the human race and the way that Blatty writes it is maybe one of the most devastating things in the entire franchise, in either one of those books or in any of the movies. And it just, it kind of kills me watching that movie in either cut, in the theatrical cut that apparently was, at least in Blatty's eyes, kind of compromised. I still think it's amazing. Or even in the Legion cut that was on the Scream Factory Blue that came out not that long ago. Neither one of those had that sort of conclusion reached by Kinderman. And I was kind of like, it seems like the book was written to get to that line, to that thought. And neither movie elected to wrestle with that. And that kind of bums me out. As much as I love the movie, and I do, it just kills me. And that's why I would recommend to any listener out there, like, just pick up Legion, pick up the book. It's brilliant. Check it out.
Great. Yeah. And, we might as well talk about the other two, you know. You know, one was Paul Schrader, correct?
Paul Schrader on the first, Rennie Harlan on the second.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was actually meant to be the craziest thing about the episode that we did of this show last year. Apparently he hadn't talked about it. But Tom McLaughlin, who directed, you know, Friday Six and One Dark Night, and, you know, a very talented guy, he had apparently pitched the prequel and had the job before anybody else. And he was the one who had brought in, I think it was Caleb Carr, the Alienist writer, to write the script. And he had, he had visited with Blatty, who was not keen on the idea of any more sequels being made, and told him that he would, publicly bash the film if he decided he didn't like it. And so McLaughlin had promised that if at any point he felt like the movie would not live up to the highs of the franchise at that point, that he would step away. And ultimately, he stepped away, and then it became a John Frankenheimer movie, and then unfortunately Frankenheimer passed away, and then it became a Paul Schrader film, and then what happened, which is one of the craziest things I think in Hollywood history. Well, maybe not that, but I mean, so
they
far as movies
remade
produced,
it with a different director.
Has that ever happened? I asked him that too, and he couldn't really think of anything. But to your knowledge, do you know of any other time that that's happened where you essentially had one concept, pretty much the same cast, but ultimately two different screenplays, two different directors, two different budgets? They essentially spent $80 million to have one $40 million movie to release in the theaters.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, my question is, because I'm going to tell a little bit of a story. I know some people that work at Warner, and way back before they came out. Now, did Frankenheimer finish his cut before he died, and then Paul Schrader?
I don't think he started shooting. I think it was ultimately a project that was inherited by Schrader, and then
whatever happened. My buddy from Warner Brothers calls me up. I was out in L.A. working, and he goes, "Dude, got to come over." And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "We're working on the new Exorcist. I want you to see it." And I'm like, "What? Oh my God!" You know, so I run over there. It was like on a work tape. It wasn't finished. It had, you know, scene missing. This, the effects were not in it. You know, it had clapboards and some stuff. I mean, it was, It was amazing. And even without it being finished, it was a good movie. And I go, well, what's the problem? They're like, oh, you know, they're trying to fix it. And I go, this is a good movie. What the fuck is the problem? And they go, well, you know, the executives don't like it. You know, we're trying to, you know, fix it. And I go, finish it. I mean, edit it, finish it, mix it, put the effects in, you know. And then they did, and it was, ugh.
The Jackals.
I go, you know, this was, I mean, I had more fun watching the raw version of the movie than the actual finished film. You know, so, you know, Paul Schrader, you know, made a decent movie. And I think they messed it up in finishing it, you know. And then the Rennie Harlan one, I don't remember too much about.
You know what's crazy is that I think most people have an opinion, and I mean, they can certainly stick to that opinion, too. I completely understand if they want to. But I mean, the sort of prevailing opinion, I think, of the Exorcist prequel debacle is that Rennie Harlan's was the studio hack job and that Paul Schrader's was like the art house gym that never got to see the light of day until, you know, much later on. But watching them both, I don't think either movie is a success, but I don't think either movie is a complete failure either. I think the Dominion that Schrader made is kind of, I hate to say, I love Schrader, but I, you know, the movie is quite dull in spots, but then there are these moments that are actually
fantastic. I can guarantee you it wasn't. That's the thing. I mean, it wasn't a dull movie, and you know, maybe it was the excitement that I had of seeing it, you know, before anybody else really. You know, I was lucky enough to see the raw version with no color timing or sound or, you know, effects or anything. And, you know, that when you see something like that, you kind of go, hey, this is awesome. You know, so maybe that tainted my view of it just because of the excitement of seeing The Exorcist, you know, prequel before anybody else. But I recall going, what's the problem with this? This is actually a really good movie. And then when I saw the finished version, I was like, this isn't what I remember, you know? So, I mean, I think maybe it was ruined in post-production, you know, it was just not as exciting, you know, edited in such a way, or maybe the music and, you know, things that were in it just kind of, but I agree with you. The finished version of the Schrader cut or movie was just kind of like, eh.
Yeah. Yeah. It wrestles with some really interesting ideas, which the Harlan movie doesn't really, but at the same time, the Harlan movie sort of, at least it's entertaining, you know, it has a pulse. And so I think the perfect version of that exists somewhere in between the Schrader version and the Harlan version, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, we'll probably, you know, we'll be blessed with an Exorcist remake, I'm sure, at some point. Weren't they talking about that? Like remake. I mean, they did the TV show.
I was going to say, I had assumed for the longest time that the television show was going to be a remake. And then spoilers for anyone out there who has not watched the first season of The Exorcist yet, the television series, but just skip ahead like 20 seconds. But, you know, it's not a remake at all. It's a sequel.
No, it's a sequel. Yeah.
Which I got to ask, how did you feel about the TV show?
I loved it. The reveal, I didn't know. You know, it's like you're watching a TV show and, you know, I kind of chalk it up for, you know, I left social media a couple of years ago, you know, pretty much except
smart man.
For Instagram. I got rid of Facebook and everything else. So, you know, I'm not in that world of, hey, you know, guess what? You know, here's what happens, you know, on tomorrow night's Twin Peaks, you know, because somebody got a leaked copy and they posted, you know, I don't see that stuff anymore. So when the big reveal happened in the Exorcist TV show, I was like, what? You know, I was like, holy shit, that's amazing. You know, and I really, really liked it. And I was happy to, you know, read in the trades that they actually are doing a second season.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what they do, because I got to say, the first season of the show, like, had a lot of, to me, a lot of great stuff in it. And I love the performances and I love the look of it. And I love how damn dark it was. I think that's probably the darkest, meanest show I've seen on network television since Hannibal.
It was
nasty. But at the same time,
really
there were
nasty show.
Oh, there were some choices in it too that
like,
just
what
sort
the
of
fuck.
Yeah. But some of the choices sort of made me roll my eyes a little bit. Like, some things didn't completely land for me. But I will say, by the time the first season ended, it had pretty much won me over. And I was like, I hope they get a second season. And now that they have gotten a second season, and apparently they are moving away from the story that we have kind of been, handcuffed to, as it were, for all those movies.
They're off chasing Pazuzu and foreign lands.
Goodness it's not going to be like that. Like, it sounds like they're going to take the two priest characters and send them off into another adventure that's not going to rely on anything that we've seen before. So now that it can kind of do its own thing and it's divorced itself from the continuity of the movies, I'm really excited, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do.
I like everything Exorcist in a way. It's such an interesting, there's been so many, it's like George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. He made Night of the Living Dead, and there were all these, copycats out there. I mean, The Exorcist comes out, and you got, To the Devil a Daughter, and, you
love
got all
movie.
These movies that sort of jumped on the Satan movie bandwagon, or, the demonic, bandwagon, like Beyond the Door and stuff like that.
I still haven't seen, is it Abby, I think?
Abby, the one that a major studio owns, I guess, and they won't release for whatever reason. Is that the problem with that one?
People keep saying that it's a surprisingly great Exorcist knockoff that needs to be seen, and yet that's sort of like one of the dark spots in my, my being a fan of horror movies, is I've never been able to catch that one.
I want to say a company actually tried to get away with putting that out on DVD at one point, and then I think it was Warner Brothers that laid the smackdown and said, nope, you're not doing it.
Is it because of The Exorcist? Is it kind of like a Jaws, White Shark sort of thing?
Yeah, I think so, and that's another one that bothers me. It's like, why not? I mean, who gives a shit if Great White is a complete ripoff of Jaws?
Sales on that really cut into Jaws Blu-ray sales?
Well, I think the problem is if it's, there's so many of those Jaws ripoffs. I think the problem is that it actually uses footage from Jaws in the movie. So I think that's why Universal's like, I could be thinking of a different shitty Italian shark ripoff. But I think Great White actually maybe uses some of the underwater stuff from Jaws, and that's why they're a little pissed. And doesn't it have, like, the Quint character as Quint, pretty much, and the police character as the policeman, pretty much, and the scientist as the scientist? So, I think with Abby, it's an Exorcist ripoff, but there's plenty of those. So I don't understand why, Warner Brothers would be so quick to, say, nope, you can't, you're not allowed to see this. It's not like it's going to cut into the billions of dollars they've made on the franchise or anything,
I don't understand why and maybe you could give me some insight too. Like, I always wondered in cases like that, maybe Great White does use clips from Jaws, and maybe Abby is a little too close, for comfort for Warner Brothers, maybe it is a little too similar to The Exorcist. But has there ever been, to your knowledge, like, any sort of attempt in cases like that for the owners of such a movie to approach the studio and say, look, just let us put it out, and what percentage of, whatever we make off of it would you like? Are they willing to play ball in that way typically, or no?
I don't think so. I think they're so wrapped up in the ramifications. I mean, the smallest of legal things puts a giant halt on things with studios. And, the perfect example would be like with Phenomena for us. We put out Phenomena. Well, New Line Cinema put out the edited version called Creepers.
Yeah.
Back in 84. Well, or 85 or whenever it was. And, we're like, hey, we want to, use some of your material because you've got the New Line catalog. I go to Warner Brothers. I approached them, and they're like, what do you mean you're doing Phenomena? We own that movie. And I go, No, you don't. That's not Creepers. This is, you know, well, we have a deal for this movie with, you know, and I had to explain to them that, you know, that Phenomena has been out in the U.S. from multiple companies. And
I was going to say, wasn't it on like an Anchor Bay DVD at one point?
We have a legal license for this movie and blah, 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 blah. And all I wanted was their material for Creepers. And it opened up this giant can of worms with legal that took a year to resolve over the tiniest of things. I was like, look, guys, we own Phenomena. If you own Creepers, that's fine, but I would like to use your material. Well, we think we own Phenomena too. You're not allowed to put that out. It's like, so it opened up this horrible thing. And you know what happened was they're like, well, we need a chain of title from the people that you bought it from. And they pulled out their paperwork they had. They're like, look, this was a deal with New Line. It ended, right, at a certain time. And you don't own this movie anymore. And after a year of waiting, I kid you not, we sat on Phenomena for a year. And one day we get an email from Warner Brothers that says, yeah, you're right. We don't own it. You can have our stuff. I go, what the fuck? A year of waiting. And this is what you're like, oh, yeah, you're right. Here, take it. Here's our vault list. Get it out of here. I was like, you've got to be shitting me. I waited a year for this to get resolved. And I have a feeling that that's the kind of thing that would happen with some of these other movies, you know, that are sort of iffy on the intellectual property ripoff meter with the studios. Is they're like, great white? Yeah, you know, we don't want to pursue this legally. We'll just tell everybody that they can't show it or that they can't put it out or whatever. I think the studios have better things to do. And if you approach a studio like we did, you know, you can sit on this forever because little old, you know, Synapse doesn't mean shit to Warner Brothers or New Line when it comes to things like that. They got better things to do. They got, you know, Wonder Woman and Justice League to deal with. They're not dealing with a 30-year-old cut Argento movie that was sub-distributed by, New Line Cinema. So we get pushed to the bottom of the pile, and I have a feeling that that's kind of what's happening with some of these other films like that, you know, like Abby and whatever. They just don't have time to deal with it, and it would take forever if you tried. You know, it's like The Devils. You know, Warner Brothers has The Devils. Are we ever going to get that out of Warner Brothers?
Well, I was wondering. Yeah, I was hoping. I was like, maybe a disc release isn't too far off into the future if Shudder can play The Devils. But then, you know, it left Shudder, and now it's like, there's been no mention of any release
right,
yet.
But it also was supposedly the cut R version anyway. So, at what point do you pursue it? You know, and say, hey, let's put out The Devils, but no, you can only have the R rated one. Sorry. Oh well, let's put out the Devils anyway. Well, why bother if you can't do the other version? You know, why would you? You know, I guess, you know, any studio would be like, yeah, we're putting out the R-rated version, and all the fans would be disappointed, and maybe they would buy it anyways. But for me, I would be like, I'd rather put out the other one, please. You know, and, you know, I guess maybe Warner Brothers, maybe they only have the rights to the R-rated one. And, you know, who knows? I don't know what the story as to why The Devils is such a no-no with them. But believe me, being a fan of crazy religious horror films, I've always wanted to do The Devils, you know. And Warner, I keep bugging Warner because I know people over there. And they're like, nope, 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 nope. You know, you can ask us every couple of days and we're still going to say no, Don, you know. But I don't really have I don't really know a reason. You know, I mean, they put out The Exorcist, which is like the craziest, most horrible, nasty, you know, movie, you know, about God and the devil you could imagine. And, you know, The Devils, I mean, yeah, The Devils is pretty rough. But if Warner Brothers says, no, we don't want to put out the X-rated version because we'd have to deal with the MPAA, you know, and do all that. And you'd be surprised how the studios get all bent out of shape when it comes to having to get things approved by the MPAA.
Why would, can I ask, the movie, could it not simply just be released unrated? Like what?
Well, that's, yeah, you'd think so. But, you know, the studios, you know, they're, it's really strange. Like they'll put out the unrated version of True Romance, but you know, oh no, we could never put out the unrated version of The Devils. Nope. You know, it's like, well, why? You know, what's the, why not? You know, there's got to be another story behind The Devils that we won't know. And I guess maybe someday it'll work itself out. Maybe, you know, maybe Criterion will get it or something, you know?
All right. So speaking of Synapse and having to deal with studios and whatnot, you mentioned earlier that The Exorcist would be kind of a dream project for you. Other than restoring
absolutely.
It to its non-morph, you know, version, like what could you see yourself doing with that title, you know, putting it out? Like what would you like
do? I would put it out in its original glory in on Blu-ray and not just DVD, for one thing. I'd love to restore it. You know, it's like, it's like the Star Wars thing. You know, I don't buy that Star Wars is, you know, cut, the negative is cut up and nothing exists that would let him do the original version again. And I would just love to present the original version of The Exorcist in the mono sound. I would do, like, I'd love to get, like, Linda Blair on a commentary. I see her enough at shows. I'd love to get, you know, her to talk about it on a commentary track. And I know Eileen Dietz, you know, Eileen Dietz, who played, I guess you'd play, you could say that she played Pazuzu in the movie. You know, that's her face on the stove in the new version of the film, in the version you've never seen. Hey, there's Eileen on the stove. I make fun of her, of that, you know, with her, when I see her, I was like, hey, your face is on the stove. You know, I'd love to get the story, and I don't know if it's ever been covered, but, you know, there's a little bit of that controversy about why Linda Blair didn't win the Oscar. You know, you hear the story about Mercedes McCambridge causing her to not win, and then you hear the story about Eileen Dietz causing her to not win, because Eileen Dietz was doing some of the stunts and not Linda. And, you know, Mercedes McCambridge was Linda Blair's voice, so it wasn't really Linda Blair doing the, and Linda Blair lost the Oscar that year.
I had never heard of that.
Yeah. And there's this weird sort of thing about, well, is it Mercedes McCambridge that caused her to not get the Oscar? Or is it Eileen, or a combination of both? Now, I don't know if any of these people would want to talk about it, but I'd sure love to try.
That'll make for a hell of a featurette, I would think.
Yeah, you know.
Now,
would
you try to get
to
them into the same
that.
Room to talk about it, or would this have to be separate?
I don't know.
I wonder if there's still
know.
Bad blood there because
Eileen.
Of it.
I don't know what the situation is. I mean, Eileen, when I go to L.A., sometimes I go out to dinner with her or whatever. So, you know, I haven't really talk to her about it, but I'd love to know, you know, how they all feel about it.
I just wonder how different Linda Blair's career looks if, you know,
exactly.
She's not Linda Blair, she's Academy Award winner Linda Blair. Like, what is
right.
What does her career look like in the 80s, you know?
You know, I mean, we all have, you know, our things that, you know, in our lives that really irritate us, you know. I have, you know, I started in this business and got into the, you know, started Synapse after Elite. I got enough stories to fill a book, but I, you know, do I want to talk about it? Probably not. You know, it's just, so maybe they would feel the same way, but I would love to know how Linda feels about it. And, you know, with Eileen and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I would love to sit down and do a commentary with William Friedkin that's moderated, because the commentary that he did on that first version of The Exorcist is unlistenable to me.
Oh.
it, you know, sorry, William, but that commentary.
He listens.
And here we go. Here we go up the stairs, and here's a shot of the room, and then we go out of the room and down the stairs, and here comes Reagan's mom into the kitchen. It's like, stop narrating the movie and tell us something about the movie, please. You know, there's a commentary that he did where he's basically just narrating what's happening on screen, and it's infuriating to me. Because I love this movie so much. I don't want to hear William Friedkin, you know, giving me English descriptive services, you know, on the disc. I don't need him to say, and here comes Reagan walking down the stairs, and here she goes out the door, and here she, you know.
I got to say, as much as I love him, I feel kind of the same way about John Carpenter's audio commentaries, too.
Yeah, I haven't, to be honest with you, outside of my own stuff, the last real commentary I listened to was Robert Wise on the Haunting DVD. So I haven't really listened to commentaries.
I used to be a commentary fiend when I was a kid, you know, because it was such a novelty to hear a filmmaker talk at length about the work that they had made. But now it's kind of like, I can't tell you the last time I listened to a commentary all the way through. I just realized I'm not just saying that. I honestly cannot remember the last commentary that I listened to.
Yeah.
That kind of bums me out.
I love the people that do the extras. I mean, you know, we deal with a lot of people that do some amazing extras for things. You know, Shout Factory has some great stuff. You know, Red Shirt Pictures does great stuff. Motley Hoo does some great stuff for us. But I would rather just see like an ultimate version of a movie than any extras. I honestly, unless it's like added, you know, deleted scenes or outtakes, I kind of steer away from them. I don't really watch a lot of extras. And I just want to, you know, I'd rather have all the bits be utilized to make the movie look the best it can be, you know, on the physical media. But, you know, for The Exorcist, I don't know. I mean, I would love to just do it the other way. And there's, I wouldn't have to make too many changes, I guess. But then again, the version you've never seen has all that other stuff in it that I would want out, you know. I would love to get the original negative of The Exorcist and just do a 4K of that.
That would be great. Now, what's the likelihood that that can happen? Because I know, you know, Shout Factory with their Scream Factory label did
never.
Well, they did The Exorcist 3, so, you know, why can't Synapse do The Exorcist?
I mean, that wasn't Warner, that was Morgan Creek. So, you know, you're dealing with a different entity. You know, the Warner Brothers would probably license anybody, anything they would want to do outside of the devils, as long as the money was right, you know. But how much is right? You know, I mean, you hear stories about, you know, certain movies costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to license, and you just kind of roll your eyes and go, no way, you know, there's no way. But, you know, for something like The Exorcist, you know, it's not going to be cheap. And I mean, like with Suspiria, which was technically our first, you know, 4K DCP and, you know, first real, you know, 4K restoration. I know how much that cost. And, you know, it's just like, okay, The Exorcist is going to cost at least this much. And it's just like, you know, you just want to, you look at the bills and you just kind of want to throw up. You know, we're not a major studio that can handle doing, you know, 4K restorations and stuff for everything. You know, we don't own the movie forever. So, you know, getting The Exorcist would be, okay, you guys can have it for, you know, 5 years, and then you got to give it back. And it's like, well, you know, you'd have to spend what, a couple of hundred thousand or more, and only get the movie for 5 years. You know, and it's just like, could we ever make our money back at that point? And you go, well, yeah, it's The Exorcist, but I don't know. I mean, I'd love to try. I'd love to do The Exorcist. It's really like the last movie on my bucket list that I've never been able to actually work on. You know, when I got into this business, I had like a list of like 10 movies that I wanted to do, and I've pretty much done them all except for The Exorcist. I've always felt that that would be out of reach for me. you know, as a small company that, you know, we're a company of two guys, you know, in a dusty office off of the Detroit airport, you know, off of a road in the back of the airport. And, you know, it's tough.
But, what can fans do to help? Where can we send letters to make this
happen? Well, you know, we could always start a Kickstarter campaign. And ask for like $1 million. We need $1 million to do The Exorcist. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, you know, I keep bugging, you know, I know the guys who do like the archive division too of Warner Brothers. And I keep bugging them about movies. And they're like, well, you know, maybe someday. And I'm like, well, if you're not going to do it, give it to me. You know? So, but they did announce one that I kept bugging them about. So maybe if I just keep bugging them about certain movies, maybe they'll eventually come out. And then I won't have to do them, but the fans will still get them. Like The Hidden. You know, The Hidden was one that I've been bugging Warner Brothers about for ages. My buddy who works in home video, I was like, do the hidden, you know, for 3-4 years I've been bugging them. Of course, now it's coming out. So, you know, on their Warner Archives label. So maybe if I keep bugging them, maybe they'll do Looker someday. You know, it's like, hey, come on, get that Looker out, will you? Like, ugh. You know, they kind of roll their eyes. They go, Looker, who wants that? But me, I do, you know. Please put it out on Blu-ray. But yeah, with The Exorcist, I would love to do something. I mean, it's, you know, there's how many versions of The Exorcist have been released already, though?
I can't tell you how many.
Like five, six. You know, there's like the box set with everything. You know, it's just meh. You know, at some point, I would just love to restore the original version and put it back the way it was and get Owen Roizman to color correct or whatever, you know. Wow. You know, and get him to sit in and do it his way, you know, because his way may not be Friedkin's way. You know, obviously with the French Connection, it wasn't. So, you know, to get the DP, you know, to supervise is like what we did with Suspiria, for example, you know. What I went right to Luciano Tavoli and said, hey, you want to help? And he's like, sure. You know, sit down, get the DP involved. And, you know, because they're the people behind the camera. They're the people that set the lights. They're the people that shoot. They're the people that basically make the images that you see on the screen. It's the DP. And they're, you know, to me, they could input more about what the picture is supposed to be sometimes than the director can in certain instances, you know. And to get Owen Roizman to sit down with the original version of The Exorcist and do it, I would just love that.
I'm kind of amazed get him that on hasn't a commentary. Happened yet, especially with all of the various versions.
Yeah, maybe
versions
it did.
Had.
I mean, is the version you've never seen color corrected by Owen Roizman, or is it William Friedkin? See, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
You know, just get them and then get a commentary with them, and you know, do a like a technical commentary on The Exorcist about how they did things and the reason why they picked the film that stock that they did and the lights that they did and the, you know, last time I watched The Exorcist, I noticed that, you know, like things had changed, because if you look at the first DVD of The Exorcist that came out, the one that has the jump cut, and you look at the version you've never seen, the color correction is totally different.
Really?
You know, it is. Yeah, it's like, whoa, that's different. You know, it doesn't look the same. It's almost like the new version is polished for a new generation, you know. I mean, it looks good. Don't get me wrong. It's absolutely beautiful and sharp and the grain and everything, but it's not the same movie. I mean, it looks very different than the original version. You know, it's a little darker, and, you know, it also could be the technology at the time that DVD was made. You know, they just didn't have the scanners or the computers that they have today. But then again, when they made the movie in 73, they didn't either. So, you know, what did the movie originally suppose, what was it originally, you know, I don't remember what it looked like back when I was a kid, but, you know, I would just love to do that, the original version. Do that mono sound mix with it, you know, supervised by Owen Roizman, and get them on commentaries and do a moderated commentary with Friedkin, you know, about the making of the movie, where we could ask the question, you know, and see if he'd answer them or not. You know, about all the ghost stories, you know, that you hear, you know, there's the rumors about how the set was cursed and it burned down and 9 people supposedly died. You know, is all that bullshit, or was that all, you know, was that made up for publicity, or did that stuff really happen? You know, you hear about all these horrible things that happened on the set, you know. I want to know about that stuff.
That would be great. I really hope that happens at some point. I have my fingers crossed for it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a classic. It's my favorite horror film of all time. You know, it's, you know, that's number one for me. Number two is Dawn of the Dead, and I worked on Dawn of the Dead already. So, you know, it's like, I really would love to do The Exorcist one day. The Exorcist is the king, and I recommend, like, I can't imagine any of your listeners have not seen it yet, honestly.
No, there's no way.
Yeah, but I mean, if there's somebody out there that's listening to this and has never seen The Exorcist, just do yourself a favor and watch it, and don't laugh, because it's not funny. it's not a funny movie, okay? You know, I get it. You know, the audiences are changed, but putting on your "Hey, this movie was made," you know, for, you know, 50 years ago hat.
Wow.
And you kind of sit down and you think about the times and, you know, the era of non-computer effects and everything, you know, the makeup, the Dick Smith practical effects makeup, and the things that they did with the wires and everything. It's a huge achievement in horror for a number of reasons, and it deserves to be watched.
All right, sir. I can't think of a better place to stop than there. Thank you so much for being on the show and for picking such a great movie to talk about. Now, can I ask, where can folks find you at online? I know you mentioned that you sort of pulled away from social media, but I was wondering if there's any place you'd like to point fans to.
We do have a Facebook page, For Synapse. It's not run by me. It's run by our PR people. But, you know, we are available on, you know, email. You can go to synapse-films.com. There's a email form there, and it goes right to me and Jerry. So if you have any questions, you know, you'll know that we'll be, one of the two of us will be the answerer of those questions if you email us. And you can always call our office, too. We love to chat with our fans. So all the info is on synapse-films.com.
Very cool.
And I'm on Instagram. I'm on Instagram too, but not under Synapse. So it's under my name, just Don May Jr.
Okay, very cool.
That's more of a personal thing, you know. I kind of left the social media world a while back because it was just getting a little too volatile, you know.
Have you seen it recently? Have you seen social media recently?
No.
It's a good time to stay away.
You know, I couldn't deal with, you know, waking up with my morning coffee, checking Facebook, and, you know, people posting, like, you know, my favorite example is like posting a picture of a beautiful sunrise, you know, hey, it's beautiful, you know, sunrise today, what a beautiful morning, blah, blah, blah. And then somebody was like, you know, fuck you, my dog died last night. Like, really? You know, okay,
I mean,
I'm
feel
done.
Bad for the dog, but...
You know, I was like, I'm out. I can't deal with this. You know, you can post the most. You could post the most beautiful thing on Facebook or on social media, and someone will just go out of their way to shit all over whatever you do. And I'm like, okay, I'm out. So I am no longer on Facebook. I haven't been on Facebook for almost 3 years.
I have never had a Facebook account, and I'm okay with that. I am solely on Twitter, but even Twitter is like, I got to tell you, between I have a lot of friends on Twitter. I love Twitter. Twitter's great when it's great. But honestly, between watching the news in the morning and then getting on Twitter throughout the day, I'm just it depresses
me. I don't twat either. So, you know, I don't have a Twitter account. You know, I can't take that joke. I think Stephen Colbert did that joke. He's like, I don't plot. So neither do I. But I'll post pictures on Instagram once in a while. It seems to be pretty neutral over there. So, but yeah, I mean, if anybody's trying to find us, our info is on our website. And yeah, give us a call or email us, and we'll be glad to talk.
Very cool. Now, can I ask, what can we keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Okay, well, we are finishing up Suspiria.
I can't wait.
And that will be out for the 40th anniversary this year. We're also working with a deal with Fox where they are actually distributing the 4K DCP for us. So
fans can actually see the film in a theater.
Yes, they can. And, you know, you can, if you are a theater owner, you know who to call to do your thing with Fox, and you could probably program our 4K DCP at any day now. So, you know, if you want to get your Halloween screenings in, you're more than welcome to call Fox and book it, and then let us know when you do so that we can promote it. We've got a Massacre at Central High, which we are doing. Rene Dalder's film. He was gone for a while. We had started the project, and he was wanting to shoot some extras and he was doing a movie, and then we kind of laid low for a bit, and he sort of went off the grid. And he was out for a long time, and now we just got in touch again, and we've restarted our supplements for that, and Massacre at Central High is back on the schedule probably for next year, first quarter. And, we've got a couple of other surprises that we have signed recently that I can't talk about, but there is one really fun 80s horror gem that I think the fans will be happy that we're doing.
Can you give us the vaguest of hints?
Well, it wouldn't be very vague, but let's just say we've been working on it for a while. And those fans who know our films that we've announced can kind of figure it out. they might go, but it's now happening.
Are you are you going to continue the line of Steelbooks?
Yeah, the Steelbook thing. It's very divisive. You know, there's fans that love them.
I count myself among them.
Yeah, and then there are all those people that are like, please don't put out those shitty Steelbooks. I'm OCD, and I can't stand the way they look on my shelf next to my blue cases. it's like, well, dude, you've got a problem, and it's called mental. If you're talking about how you don't like the Steelbooks because they don't look right next to your plastic blue, normal Blu-ray cases on your shelf, and that drives you nuts, you need medication.
I got to tell you, on my shelf, altogether, I have the Synapse line of Steelbooks. I have Demons and Demons 2. I have Popcorn. I have Phenomena. I have Tenebrae. Those things, okay, yeah, maybe they don't match with the other, like you said, cheap plastic cases on your shelf, but they sexy up a shelf more than any other Blu-ray I have on there.
I honestly had a conversation with someone who actually said, I don't like the Steelbooks because they don't look right. They don't look right with everything else. And I go, so why don't you just create a section of Steelbooks and put it separately so that all the Steelbooks right next to each other look like they belong together? And they're like, oh, yeah. And I'm like, I wanted to slap my head and go, I put things in my shelves alphabetically, right? I don't care if I have an Alien Covenant Steelbook next to the cardboard box of the Alien, quadrilogy. It's just there, But we actually have people who complain that because they don't like the way the spines look, they don't like the Steelbooks. Like, it doesn't look right with all my other plastic cases, so please don't put Steelbooks out.
I will say the only time that ever bugged me, I completely understand what you're saying, and if it's like there's a different type of case from title to title to title, I don't mind a bit. If some of them don't have the little O-ring like the cardboard cases, fine. But then some of them do, fine. It doesn't bother me. I'm not OCD in that way. But I will say there is a section of my collection with the Resident Evil films, and it literally goes, the six theatrical features are all in steel cases. The first animated feature is in a steel case. The third animated feature is a steel case. And then there's that one son of a bitching second animated film that they never released on steel. And it's just it's just wrong. Like, that does bug me.
Right, yeah. Well, you know, look, I mean, again, that's a weird mental thing. You know, we all have to, I mean, do you have a bookcase and do all the books on your bookcase look exactly the same? Of course not.
Very true.
You know, but people, I don't know. It's a weird thing. I just put my stuff up on the shelf alphabetically and go with it. I like the variety, you know, it kind of doesn't make everything look like everything's all the same. You know, and I like that. You know, it's just funny. It's like, please don't put out those steelbooks because I hate them because I have a mental problem. You know, and it's like, dude, please.
I remember there were fans who were giving, I think, Scream Factory hell for doing the anniversary editions of some of their titles in steelbook. And it's like, I guess there is a, and I know some guys who are sort of diehard collectors who need like every single Scream Factory title in existence.
Sure,
I don't understand that, but they're like, now I have to drop 40 or 50 or God knows how much for each one of these steelbooks just to have them when I already have them. I'm like, you don't actually have to.
That's what I say. It's like, nobody's twisting your arm. You don't have to buy anything. You don't have to buy anything.
I will argue point with you. I feel like I have to buy that Suspiria Blue when it comes
out. You feel like you have to, but that's a mental problem. You know, we all have to work through. I have my problems. You know what my thing is I'll buy like Xbox and PS4 video games, right? And I never play them.
What?
I never play them. I buy like all these, like the games that that's my thing. And it's a mental problem I have. I'll go, I'll be like, well, I need to get that, that Tekken 5 or whatever. I'll get it. And then it'll sit on my shelf. I'll pay $59.95 for it to get it on the Tuesday it comes out. And then by the time I get around to playing it, they've had the Game of the Year edition for $19 with all the add-ons, and I still got the sealed one that I paid on the first day for $60. That's my hang-up, that I can't seem to, I'll go and I'll buy a video game, and then I'll never sit and play it. Now, with movies, I have so many movies in my collection that I haven't opened yet, but I actually make a concerted effort to sit down and try to watch as many as I can. But you never seem to catch up.
Never. That is my problem.
You're like,
I'll watch
five movies this weekend. I'll cut into it, my pile. And then like the next day I'll get like eight movies from Diabolik or something. You know, it's like, oh shit, now I'm screwed. But that's the thing. It's like, we like the steelbooks. The steelbooks are a success for us. I like those people on the internet that thought that, hey, they haven't sold 3,000 units of Demons 1 in 2 weeks, so it must be a failure. You know, they have no concept of the business and how it worked. But the steelbooks are very good sellers for us, and we like them. And we understand there's a lot of people that don't. And, we get it. I'll get a steel book from like a Target or a Best Buy or whatever. Like, I bought the Creed steel book at Target, right? It was in the steel book. And it had like the tip on the back with the thing. And then I get it home and there was a huge gash in the back of the steel book that was covered up by the paper that I didn't see. And then by the time I went back to the Target to go get it replaced, all the steelbooks were gone. So, that's a thing where you'll get something that's damaged and it's really irritating. And then there's such a low quantity that you end up not getting a replacement steelbook if it's dented or whatever. But, that's the hangups with the steelbooks, is they're very delicate, and I get it. They scratch easy and they get fingerprinted up and stuff, but we're a collector's market company, and that's you know, we're not a mass market company. We don't have every release sitting on the shelves of Best Buy or Walmart or Kmart for $9.99 or $13. You know, our specialty is doing movies for the collector. And the collectors like that kind of stuff. And that's our market, I guess, as it were. We try to do these collector's editions. And, you know, they seem to be successful for us, so we'll continue to do them. Not every movie we're going to do is going to be in the Steelbook, but we think the Argentos are important enough to actually do them that way.
Oh, absolutely. And I got to say, as a fan, too, like I appreciate the work that you guys do. I think those Steelbooks are amazing. I think the releases that you guys put out, you can tell that a lot of effort and love have gone into them. And I wasn't lying earlier during the intro when I was talking about you guys having the most kick-ass table. To all the listeners out there, if you can manage to get to a horror convention where Synapse has a setup, like you won't really even have to look that hard for it. It'll be where everybody else is, elbow to elbow, rifling through all the titles.
Right.
Table.
Yeah.
Like that is usually stop number one whenever I hit a horror con. So,
well, we are, you know, speaking of shows, we are doing Horror Hound in Indy. It's coming up soon. And we are doing Cinema Wasteland in Strongsville, Ohio. So are two shows that we are doing.
Now, are you doing the Horror Hound follow-up in Columbus?
Yeah, we've talked about it. I haven't seen much about it.
Neither have I, I'm starting to worry about it a little bit.
I was going to call Aaron and Nathan at the Horror Hound and find out what was going on, because it's like we haven't heard hide nor hair about anything going. We heard that something was happening in Columbus, but we haven't heard anything since, and I don't know. I guess when I go into the office tomorrow, maybe the first thing I do is I'll give them a call and find out what's up, because I haven't heard much. But I'm glad it's coming back to Columbus, because the Columbus show was pretty cool the last time.
I don't think I've ever been to a Columbus show of theirs. It's either been, Cincinnati or Indianapolis. But yeah, I guess, I don't know. I can only assume that they're putting all of their effort into promoting the indie show right now. And as soon as it drops, they have, what, maybe a month and a half to promote the Columbus show?
Yeah.
So
yeah. Maybe I'll ask them. Maybe I'll see if we win a show Suspiria over there.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah,
all right, sir. Well, I think I've taken up way too much of your time. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
I like talking. I didn't even have to leave the phone at all. So I'm perfectly good. No drinking water. No stopping for the restroom. No, it was a great conversation.
We really appreciate your time, and thank you again for choosing such a great movie to chat about. I had a blast.
All right, and me too. Thank you so much.
All right, and thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, rate and review us on iTunes, leave feedback, and give us a yell on Facebook and Twitter. That's at Scream Addicts, and I'm at Jinx1981. Until next time, folks, thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
John Garfield, in body and soul.
Exactly, John Garfield. People tell you that, Father.
Do people tell you look like Paul Newman?
Always.